Hi, and welcome to Jackie Winter Gives You the Business. I'm Jeremy Wartzman, and I'm here with my co-host, Lara Chambaker.
Hello.
Hello. Here at Jackie Winter, our roles put us right in the center of the action, in between client and creative, so we get to see all sides of the process. Each week, we come together in the literal sauna that is our recording studio and dissect three different links we've come across during our recent internet travels. We use these as a jumping off point to look at what's shaping the issues, processes, happenings, and ideas across the creative industries today. This week, we are going through our open tabs and we'll be discussing Australia's socialist future, ignoring the design industry, and Instagram husband. Helping us bring some outside perspective today is our very special guest, Gary Williams. Gary leads activation partnerships for the forthcoming University of Melbourne Innovation Precinct, Melbourne Connect, and the Melbourne node of the Global Science Gallery Network. He's the founder of Alts Project, a collective on the way, focused on unconventional career paths and projects that consume us, resulting in curation of content and events, including Melbourne Tech, Fuck Up Nights, and various tech, culture, and community initiatives. Closer to home, Gary's also been on the Creative Mornings team for how many years now, Gary?
I think it's around two. Someone actually asked me this morning, and I had to think about it for once. But it's been a fast 2 years.
It has been.
And Gary's also done a bunch of our real IRL Open Tabs events, which we are still running. And I hope to have you back for, because you're awesome.
Oh, I love Open Tabs. As you would have seen the first time, I went about double the amount of time that I was meant to. So yeah. Thanks for inviting me back.
Yeah, there were a few sort of coach signals at the back, sort of making the tea with my hands, like, come on, go. Yeah, but yeah. We got there.
No, I kept it sharp the second time around.
Oh, Gary, we're happy to have you here today. And it's a bit of a treat for me because it's my second time seeing you today because we did have Creative Mornings this morning. Lara, how are you going?
I'm warm. It's 42 degrees here in Melbourne today. But luckily, we have a highly air-conditioned office. I managed to squeeze in two beach trips before work this morning.
Rub it in.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's about to head to 44 degrees Celsius today, apparently, which for our metric friends or non-metric friends is 111.2 degrees Fahrenheit.
Sounds disgusting.
Too hot.
Too hot, officially.
Too hot.
How are you, Jeremy? Too hot.
Could be worse. Could be Adelaide.
Well, that's true.
Yes. No, I'm hot. You know, I'm hot. I'm forgetting things.
Yeah, and you know it, Jeremy. Yeah.
But no, yeah, I was just going to get stuck straight into it. I don't have anything witty to say. I'm just kind of just holding on to everything just to get my, you know, opinions across in these links.
As always.
So I think we will get started, Lara, with your first link from The Guardian this week. Tell us a bit about what you got.
Yeah, this is a piece that our colleague Micah shared on Slack this week. It's written by John Quiggin, as he said, for The Guardian. And in the piece, he sort of imagines this post-capitalism future of Australia in 2050. Now, as well as being an accomplished journalist, Quiggin is an Australian Laureate Fellow in Economics at the University of Queensland. He's really prominent both as a research economist and as a commentator on Australian economic policy. And he's also a fellow of the Econometric Society, the Academy of the Social Sciences in Australia, and many other societies and institutions. So I just wanted to note that whilst the piece, you know, is certainly sort of fantasy fiction in some senses, he's also coming from a really informed standpoint. He's not just, you know, it's not me writing this. So in 2017, he also wrote this really interesting piece. I'll link to it in the newsletter, where he defines modern socialism as social democracy with a spine. It's this sort of blending with the systems of democracy, but with a deeper focus on inequality and unemployment, such as, you know, universal basic income, free education, increases in minimum wage, and so on. So that old piece is a really good read. I highly encourage people to check it out. But in this new piece, he's sort of taken the liberty of actually imagining future in which all of this has actually played out. So his depiction is set in 2050, so a few decades into this sort of imagined socialist resurgence, but still sort of well before the emergence of a society that could, I guess, truly be described as socialist in the classic sense of the term. And his aim here was to look at things in both a sort of very hopeful utopian way, but also with efforts to be realistic in terms of economic constraints and, you know, trying not to sort of invoke any very radical or unlikely changes in human nature, which is, you know, often the criticisms of these sort of socialist utopias. So he imagines this couple, for people who haven't read the article, he imagines this couple in their 30s, Sam and Ali, and he breaks down how each of their lives play out in this new future. And he talks about how Ali went on to further education after high school, all of which had been made free back in 2025. Sam, on the other hand, chose not to go to uni, but instead received a $100,000 grant when he was 20 to be used in starting a small business. And he goes on to describe their lives, making mention of the sort of second global financial crisis of 2021, which, I mean, that doesn't sound far-fetched to me, and how, you know, after this long depression that followed the crisis, no government was willing to risk giving financiers another chance to destroy the economy, which led to the downfall of the global banking sector that sort of dominates our current financial capitalism. And sort of in place of investment banks and hedge funds, we see this return to the sort of safe, dull banking that we had in the 1950s, along with sort of community banks, credit unions, etc. He also talks about there's a, you know, a standard 4-day, 30-hour work week. Jeremy, take note. Most workers enjoy 8 weeks of annual leave. He says that despite predictions of ruin from the business sector, the reduction in output was small. And after a few years, it was entirely offset by productivity growth as a result of technological progress. And then sort of most work like banking is done over the internet, which has long been provided free of charge as a public service in this world. And this sort of decline of the private business sector wiped out the advertising model on which the fortunes of companies like Google and Facebook were built. So big corporations, he imagines, have disappeared from most sectors of the economy, including the cafe and restaurant sector, thanks to the elimination of tax avoidance and wage theft and the renationalization of the monopoly infrastructure. So this also means that most formal employment is now in the public and nonprofit sectors. So things like health, education, infrastructure, social services of various kinds, manufacturing still exists as big business. But much of this work is now done by robots and computers, with a small number of workers who do remain in those high-level jobs being paid five times above the average wage, which is the legal limit imposed after the 2021 financial crisis. There's also a participation income, which is given to those who make non-market contributions to society, so child raising, participation in education, volunteering, etc. And of course, there's also the unconditional basic income for anyone who can't or won't find useful work. And he goes into this a fair bit, but basically, only a small portion of the population is on this at any given time, thanks to the universal availability of free retraining, the wide variety of opportunities to contribute, etc., meaning that this basic income genuinely serves its function as a safety net. So he mentions several other things, like the environment starting to recover from all the damage inflicted by unsustainable economic growth, transport and most industry being powered entirely by renewable energy, food production becoming more sustainable, and an expansion of publicly funded research through bodies like the CSIRO, producing sort of ranges of innovations such as like better climate forecasting, management of water resources, etc. That, although it might not have sounded like it, is a very brief recap. Those are the highlights. But yeah, really, the idea is that the socialist world of 2025 that Quiggin has imagined wouldn't be the kind of utopia dreamt up by sort of abstract theorists. It's not one of complete leisure or perfect equality, but it would provide nearly everyone with a better and safer and more stable life than we have today. And it's a really interesting notion. And while I'm the type of person who loves to read this sort of utopian economy stuff, I'm chuffed to see someone like Quiggin tackling it with the aim of realism. Whether or not he's achieved it, I'm interested to hear what you guys think, but he's trying to picture something that could actually maybe exist or even work, or as he sort of talks about a lot in the other article, needs to exist. Like, we have no other choice based on his sort of knowledge of history and the current climate. So I'll shut up. How do you guys feel when reading this? Gary, are you into this idea of a socialist semi-utopia?
Look, the article was exhaustive in a good way, yeah. I guess, because it just posed all these layers of questions where, you know, you could theorize about the elements that impact you personally. I really like the way he developed a couple of personas to then put that added context on it. And it was interesting to see elements such as referencing the advertising model on which Google and Facebook were built being eradicated, etc. So I guess towards that progression, I think with a little bit of context within the industry I work in predominantly, which is, you know, tech and startup industry, they obsessed with the notion of talking about the future of work, but more from a tools and technology perspective and how that, you know, will impact your life. So I found it really refreshing to read something which has a greater social significance talking about the state and environment. And down the bottom, he essentially references that the focus of activity has moved from consumption to the quality of life.
Mm. Yeah, so I really very like that notion as well.
Yeah.
Jeremy, you got your smirky, cynical face on. Come on.
No. Hit me. Well, look, I mean, if anyone doesn't know, like, you know, where we lean politically on this podcast, I think this will make it pretty clear. I mean, it's such
We've never been shy about that, Jeremy.
We haven't. I mean, look, I mean, it's such a it's such a hot button issue, especially like if you look at American politics at the moment, and you know, people who do kind of lean on the more kind of socialist edge, you know, how that really just has created a huge divide. I mean, you could see kind of what kind of Bernie Sanders started there, and how kind of someone like AOC also in America has kind of you know, taken that message, and how that's kind of being received. And it's pretty scary, like how, you know, how I don't understand why there's kind of such, you know, resistance to these kind of ideas. Because yeah, it makes kind of a lot of sense, and all the kind of personal qualities that I kind of find admirable, like in, you know, in people and in business, is kind of embodied by a system like this. But I think the actual, I guess, economic complexities that are kind of inherently involved in it is something that I feel really unqualified to kind of quote on, or unqualified to kind of speak about. However, I kind of think, I don't know, like it's, Australia seems to be and was like, you know, like probably one of the more socialist kind of leaning countries that I've kind of
not anymore
lived in, you know, coming not anymore, absolutely. And I kind of think, you know, when you, I think that's one of the biggest things that has changed recently. And I think when we were talking in a previous episode, especially, you know, on funding for the arts and kind of how that's kind of changed and how that exists in Australia, I think there's a huge part to kind of play in there. I mean, this piece in general, I kept waiting for it to kind of reference kind of Skynet in some way. Like I just kind of imagined like that they were saying like there was this one event and this is everything that kind of happened afterwards. But actually something happened this morning at Creative Mornings that, you know, kind of drew an interesting parallel to it. And our speaker, Jeffrey Phillips, made this really interesting, had a slide quoting from the science fiction writer Ursula K. Le Guin. I don't know if I'm pronouncing your surname right, but the quote was from Brain Pickings, the kind of website, and said, "Hard times are coming. When we'll be wanting the voices of writers who can see alternatives to how we live now, can see through our fear-stricken society and its obsessive technologies to other ways of being, and even imagine real grounds for hope. We'll need writers who can remember freedom, poets, visionaries, realists of a larger reality." So I think, you know, not kind of like, not talking about, well, I guess, yeah, using this piece in general, like I thought it was an interesting way, I guess, and I'm talking more kind of formally about the piece, like the fact that this was a piece that was kind of a piece of fiction in a way, yeah, but also not, like it was also kind of a piece of news, kind of talking about kind of actual kind of policies and how they could fit into our life. And I thought that was just kind of really interesting. And it kind of made, like Jeffrey spoke about this slide because he was talking about like, you know, what his motivation was kind of be an artist. And I think, yeah, it was,
well, because people need to see examples, even if they're just fantasy, to even be able to at all envision or work towards anything better than the current situation.
Well, that's the amazing thing about sci-fi as well. Like, you know, even if you look at something like, I mean, Nike's self-lacing shoes, which are finally becoming a reality, like, you know, would that have been there without kind of Back to the Future? Like, probably, maybe, I don't know, but you know, you need...
And are they necessary?
Well, you need those kind of things in pop culture, I think, to accelerate the ideas. And so that's kind of what I found kind of really interesting. And I guess maybe... I think we need more of this kind of writing and more of this kind of exploration to kind of make those kind of things feel a bit more feasible kind of in that way. So yeah, and I mean, that's kind of what struck me. Obviously, the part about not having advertising was a bit kind of difficult. And a lot of these ideas, like I have seen kind of, you know, rolled out, like one of our web design studios does run kind of a 4-day workflow. It's never impacted kind of our, you know, work together. So it's like, I have kind of seen actual, you know, directly experienced ways where some of these things kind of can be possible.
Other things they talk about is like 3 years of paid parental leave to share between the couple, which is like they do in parts of the world already. You know, it's like we're just kind of a bit behind on things like that.
Yeah, I mean, my biggest kind of thing is like, what's like, yeah, they obviously gloss over kind of a lot. And so it's like, well, yeah, advertising like that sustains Google and Facebook is no longer needed. But okay, the cafe that he's running kind of, and like, you know, okay, so there's no big businesses and they're kind of sharing this kind of, you know, huge marketing budget that can go kind of everywhere. And instead it's kind of broken up in smaller pieces. I would say that would even make advertising more needed, you know, and probably, well, yeah, it would obviously be different, but you have so many different people and there should be so much kind of more competition. So I kind of imagine like, well, yeah, people need to find those kind of cafes. So how are they going to be finding them? And there's going to be neat designers are still going to be needs of designing the signage that people are going to kind of go to. So yeah, like there's a lot of kind of conflicting kind of feelings in me about this.
I think there'd be ways around those things, but it's interesting. I mean, one thing that I was wanted to chat to you guys about, I guess, is, I mean, whether you think your role and what you do would exist in the same way if we were to live in this kind of post-capitalist society. Because, I mean, it's interesting to think about like how the art market might function in this sort of society. Like on the one hand, you can see how the sort of availability of a universal basic income would allow people to enter these areas without too much risk. However, like the one thing he did mention in passing in the piece, which he did not go into at all, but my brain was like, ugh, was the dismantling of intellectual property law. I don't know if you caught that. But
what was that in relation
to? It was in reference to private monopoly and big business and how the sort of abolition of IP helped to do this, right? And by getting rid of IP, like these big businesses couldn't have these giant monopolies on things. But
yeah,
that affects not only the big people, but also the little guys. He doesn't really go into it any further. Of course, like, yeah, the abolition of IP would affect the art market. But I guess the argument follows then that, like, if an artist is receiving an income anyway, then what does it matter whether the work's free to be shared or used by anyone rather than sold or licensed? But yeah, I don't know how I feel about that. Like, Jeremy?
I mean, I kind of, yeah, I understand kind of the concept and the intent of that kind of idea. And I kind of think, I don't know, like, this is kind of a bit of a non-answer, but I kind of think, I don't think that could work 100%, but I think the point of a lot of these ideas is to kind of just move away from kind of different extremes.
Yes,
I think that's kind of one extreme. Obviously, this whole piece and a lot of these ideas are kind of reactions from the extreme kind of concentration of wealth that's kind of happened so far. So it makes total sense that it needs to kind of go in that kind of other way. But I think that's kind of what's going to be really interesting in terms of things that we've talked about, like blockchain and other kind of forms of ownership and the sharing economy. So it's not, I don't think the whole idea of just kind of breaking it down completely is actually kind of feasible or desirable.
No, not like full-blown communism, but well, you are wearing a red shirt today, Jeremy. but
it's fluorescent pink.
Actually. Fluorescent pink, I'm sorry. And that's why I really recommend reading this piece in tandem with the other piece that he wrote. It's from a couple of years ago, but it's just as relevant today. Mm. And that's a more sort of serious piece, I guess, in that it's him talking, looking quite sort of strictly at socialism in the modern day and sort of not just like these big, broad utopian visions, but actual policies that we could actually begin to implement today in our current climate that would move us closer to a sort of more sort of, I guess, I don't know, social welfare minded sort of situation from what we're currently at.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. Well, even, I mean, you know, the mention of a 4-day, you know, working week. I mean, like for additional context, I mean, it's January in Australia. I don't know about yourselves, but I only really feel like people are sort of returning to work or a work mindset sort of this week, maybe probably next week. So that's, you know, since the second week of December through till basically late January that Australia is switched off to some degree. So what I took from this a little bit as well is, I guess, opportunities and a bit of freedom. So 4-day work week, how does that help prosper, I guess, people who would work a traditional sort of job or in a traditional environment, then go and action, whether it's side pursuits such as emerging startups, creative projects, etc. Whether that has a flow-on effect in that regard, I'm not sure, but
Absolutely. Surely
more freedom would.
Well, that's the thing, because for me, the really enticing thing here is that lowered risk of trying different areas of work.
Yeah.
Like me being who I am, I know that I would definitely still work in some capacity, regardless of what
same.
It is. Yeah, I no doubt, Gary, that you would, knowing who you are. I think you'd be even busier. But I think for me, it would definitely be less. I would work less, but I would still work. And I would work in a lot of different things. And I think having a confirmed income and free education, for me, would just, oh my God, I would just try everything. Because I could see so many careers I'd be happy in, but you can't. You can't just choose 40 in the current sort of state of the world. But imagine being able to try all these things or volunteer different things or whatever else it is.
I mean, but wouldn't you say that Australia has or had provided some of that in some ways? Like, isn't that kind of what the dollar is for, or kind of how HEX works and kind of the fees, the low fees compared to other places like, you know, America in terms of 40 grand a year for
compared
college?
To America, sure. But there are definitely limits and caps on what you can do here. And in terms of a long-term, I mean, maybe when you're younger, you can, but in a long-term vision of actually just sort of, without having to completely enormously shift your life or save a lot of money or whatever it is. No, you can't do that. Not even in Australia. I don't think so.
Look, I think, you know, the end result of all this is just going to be, I mean, things have to naturally kind of go in that way, because with everything kind of so concentrated, like, yeah, people need to share things. Like how else can things kind of go?
But also things are naturally moving towards this kind of sharing economy. I think at some point it's interesting because the sharing economy is run by these big monopoly businesses. So it's kind of weird. I was going to say that the two are going to have to crash into each other and something will happen at some point, but I don't know. They already are one. So I don't know. Who am I to talk about this?
That's the thing. I mean, this is this is such a deep topic. I mean, I don't think people are tuning in to kind of hear our, you know, political or economic takes. But I think, you know, as a creative exercise, I really enjoyed this piece. And I just kind of think, as a general kind of quality that the creative industries like can engender, like the whole idea of you know, generosity and compassion, all those kind of things.
If we
can put that
into
our work.
You can inject these principles into your daily life and your practice, whether that's commercial or personal.
Exactly. And I think, you know, that is something that's kind of gaining more and more kind of momentum, you know,
did
the more and more it's kind of talked about.
Commercial.
I think it did.
Commercial. I'm sorry. I just don't listen to anything you say.
Yeah, I knew it.
But no, look, this is a kind of a really great piece of writing. And look, like I said, like if sci-fi that was done in kind of the 60s and 70s kind of inspired some of the ideas that we're kind of seeing now, I think if there's more of a kind of a groundswell of this kind of aspirational work, no matter kind of what medium it is, you know, hopefully that can kind of lay the groundwork for, you know, future policies and other ways that we live our lives. And, you know, creatives have a large part to play in that. So Thanks for bringing it up, Lara.
You are welcome.
Excellent. We will move on from there. So next up is myself, and my link from the week comes from the recently relaunched Basecamp blog, Signal versus Noise. For the last few years, they were running their blog solely on Medium and recently went back to their own platform. And I got to say, bad logo, really bad logo. I really usually like Basecamp's design. I don't know, Basecamp has actually made some very questionable design decisions. But anyway, they've gone back to their own platform.
I don't hate the logo. I don't like it, but I don't hate it.
Anyway, they wrote an interesting post about it. If you want to kind of hear more about why they kind of ditched it, we'll put the links to that in the show notes.
Everyone's written a post about their logo. I'm sick of them.
No, about why they left Medium. Sorry.
Oh, right. Yeah.
So yeah, there's already been some really great writing there in addition to that post. But there's one piece in particular that caught my eye, which was posted last week by Jonas Downey. He's a designer at Basecamp, and it was titled, Why I Ignore the Design Industry on Purpose. Now, in the piece, he reflects on a few things, especially like just this new year, people ask him to kind of spot trends or reflect on controversy on two things we've covered ourselves here on the podcast. And he goes on to sheepishly admit, as he says in his own words, and I quote, I pay almost no attention to what's going on in the design industry. I don't hang out on Dribbble, or every time I see Dribbble, I just want to say Dribbble, blah, blah, blah. Sorry. same thing with Boom. Anyway.
Well, I can't say Yahoo without being Yahoo.
I latched onto that same statement immediately. So yeah, and I had a very quick reaction.
So he says, sorry, I don't hang out on Dribbble or Product Hunt. I don't read Hacker News. I don't go to design conferences or creative mornings. I don't look at inspiration sites or read designer blogs or tweets. I'm also not there networking, hustling to make connections, hard selling my personal brand, or finding to stay on top of the game. Boom. He says that he used to do those things, but eventually he burned out and shut it all down. He then goes on to state what he learned, such as how keeping up is an exhausting activity, how it negatively affected his own creativity, but in the end, he really wasn't missing out on much. So look, once again, as we predicted, the topic of focus and burnout rears its head. I have a feeling we're going to be talking a lot about it this year. And look, while Basecamp as a culture has always espoused the values of calmness and focus, and actually even kind of going back to the last link, Basecamp has always been a kind of a champion of their working policies and kind of putting it out on there, you know, much kind of...
We talked about their library rules.
Exactly. And I really think it's personal pieces like this that are really going to be what creates a larger wave of change to establish some more healthy boundaries and guidelines for what constitutes a creative diet. The other thing I really responded to this piece is that Jonas makes some comments and suggestions that really resonate with me personally, especially about looking for inspiration other places. Specifically, he writes, and I quote, instead of obsessing over what's hot, find stuff that's not. I like looking at conceptual art and old graphic design, especially from the 20s to the 60s. I listen to a ton of music, grow a garden, play guitar terribly, and so on. When you're curious and observant in your day-to-day life, unexpected things always find their way back into your work. The more diversity, the better. I found this to strengthen my creativity much more than wading through more galleries of the year's hippest design or chasing after bleeding edge tech. He also talks about finding people with outside perspectives, local community involvement, especially among non-designers / technical folk. So look, on one hand, I felt really positive about all this stuff. I noticed, especially with illustration, this is feedback that I'm always giving to kind of other illustrators because so much of what we see now just kind of looks the same. And so I'm always saying the only way you're going to get different, you know, output is to have different input. So at the same time, I mean, I also say this as speaking as the actual host of Creative Mornings, which again, we had this morning, you know, community events are a really big part of my practice. Keeping up with my RSS feeds is something that, you know, is important to me as well. So this isn't to say I'm a model citizen to demonstrate healthy online or creative habits. However, I feel in some ways, I feel this advice is a bit extreme. So like for me, it reflects someone like myself who's been in the industry for a long time and just a bit exhausted in some ways. And I just feel that some of this advice could be contextualized a bit more depending on actually where you're at in your career. But look, at the same time, I'm really not sure. So I thought it would really be good to kind of just open this up a bit more and get some reactions. So as always, my co-host and guest offer a really perfect point and counterpoint to the link this week. So Laura, I want to get started with you. As our resident young person, you seem to have...
That's my name.
You seem to have an unnatural amount of energy for attending events, reading things. I'm really kind of filling your brain with a whole variety of stuff.
Well, it's pretty empty.
Well, look, in fact, our mutual ability to keep on top of the design industry is a mandatory for putting this podcast together. So what was your kind of reaction to the assertions here?
Jeremy, I feel like you and I are about to switch places here from our usual podcast dynamic because I thought the piece was a bit unnecessary, to be honest. Like, I was on board at first, but the more I thought about it, like, the more I felt like, why should I care what this bloke thinks about interacting with your industry community? Like, you say that I'm someone who's particularly invested in industry happenings, but I'd actually argue that I'm actually kind of not anymore. I'm invested in the things that I'm naturally interested in and I'm curious about. And yes, that definitely includes aspects of the art and tech worlds, but not so much the day-to-day of advertising or design. Personally, I don't really keep tabs anymore on any industry publications like Mumbrella or Campaign Brief, unless we need to for something. But yeah, because I think, you know, when something interesting happens, I do tend to hear about it from my peers. And I would rather, personally, I'd just rather engage in that sort of stuff that way. I do enjoy listening to and actively engaging in discussions about those things, but generally just keeping an eye on ad news doesn't interest me, so I don't do it. Perhaps there are elements of my job that I would be better at if I did participate more heavily in these areas, but I know that my time is limited, and so I prefer to spend it reading and learning about other like industry adjacent stuff, like new tech or related policy or economic events.
Aren't you just backing up what he's saying in the article?
Yes,
here though?
But that stuff genuinely interests me, and what I might lack, I guess, in constantly up-to-date knowledge about which person is moving to which agency or who won what account, I make up for my knowledge about other things. And that allows me to sort of contribute to the team and industry in a wholly different way. But there are people in our team who do really enjoy staying on top of ad industry news. And so they keep that side of things covered. And that's okay. And I think on your point about it being related to where you're at in your career or your life, I think that's valid. Like, but I think it's kind of a no-brainer. Like, you just invest your time in what interests you at whatever given stage you're at. Why does he write this? I don't really get it. Like, it's the fact everyone should either pay attention or everyone should not. It's such a personal thing. Do you care about it or do you not?
Well, I mean,
you know?
Well, I mean, I want to pick this apart a bit more because I think, I mean, my reaction to the piece was that there is kind of inherent pressure in the industry to have to do these things. And we talked about this on a previous episode, but people react obviously different to different stimuli. And, you know, for some people, I think it can be overwhelming and it can kind of lead to burnout, but they feel they have to kind of keep doing it to be a kind of better designer. So look, I mean, Gary, let me, chat with you about this a bit more as well. Like, I mean, in addition to having worked together at Creative Mornings, you also play a really crucial part in organizing. You organized PauseFest this year. You're part of that committee.
Yeah.
And doing a lot of amazing community events. So, you know, you're someone whose livelihood is a result of people attending these events in some way. So I'm curious to hear, you know, your professional and personal take on the thoughts here. Like, you know, because this is something that I hear a lot about as well. Like, you know, people just burn out from kind of going to conferences and these events because there's so many kind of things out there. So do you think there's any kind of truth here?
Yeah. Look, I had sort of an extreme reaction to the article for certain purposes. I'll explain my reaction. Yeah, look, I fully am on board with the fact that you can burn out in this capacity, but I guess it really depends on the intentions of why you're there and what you're trying to achieve. If you're, I guess, referencing it from a networking perspective, or at least your knowledge consumption of what's going on. You know, I think about, Jeffrey Phillips, Jeff the Peth, spoke this morning. Jeff's attended 48 Creative Mornings, I think, and I think you've run around 96 or something. So Jeff just has inherently a need to go to Creative Mornings, and he feels fulfilled by it. He hasn't attended 46 or whatever Creative Mornings to lead through today to appear. He just genuinely likes that as part of his monthly routine, I guess. My reaction to this was sort of interesting. I read it and immediately I remembered, this is very off topic, but I'll get there. I remembered, have any of you seen that movie, The Aviator? With Leonardo DiCaprio.
Yeah.
Oh, it's Howard Hughes.
Yeah, yeah. And then I started thinking about the Simpsons episode where, you know, Mr. Burns is, you know, getting the spruce moose and all that. Because of that, I probably got interested in watching The Aviator a little while ago. And I remember one line from it, which is when Howard Hughes, Leo DiCap, is sitting with Katharine Hepburn's family. And her mother is saying during the discourse, oh, I don't care about money. And Howard Hughes says to her, you don't care about it because you have it.
Yeah.
And I don't know why that line like popped into my head while I read this. So I just found this a very privileged and sort of, I guess, conceited article. I agree with a lot of aspects of it, but even the line that you referenced about that I garden, et cetera, and play guitar terribly, I found that a little bit like, let me throw in something a little negative to make sure that I come off as a normal person.
I couldn't agree more.
But yeah. I just feel there's just no way that you can, you seek inspiration from somewhere, and there's not really an acknowledgement of the fact that how do they consume Instagram, you know, they're taking reference from somewhere, and I just didn't agree. And me and myself and Jonas may differ on this aspect.
Well, yeah, but I mean, I had wrote down at one point in my like furor, just like, all he's saying in the end is I'm in a position where I no longer need to network for the sake of networking and you should just do things in moderation, which of course is just, I mean, duh, like, of course, yeah. You know? Yeah.
Look, a large part of my role is organizing and attending a lot of community gatherings, conferences, etc. I don't need to build up any massive amount of motivation to attend them or for a large purpose, but I'm self-aware enough to know that, I guess, within my position or the amount of time that I've been there, that, you know, that I can go there comfortably knowing that I know enough people, we're working on things together. I'm not there seeking to get that big break, or if that makes sense. I'm not there with this underlying intention. I just genuinely like gathering with people, but inevitably conversations occur and interesting things pop up.
Completely. I mean, I go to talks and I read a lot. For me, it's mostly about things that are kind of non-industry related or industry adjacent, just because I get enough of that stuff in my, you know, day to day at work. And these are the things I'd like to learn about right now. But yeah, in earlier years, I went to lots of industry talks for exactly the same reason, because at that time in my life, those were the things that were new and were interesting and were valuable for me to learn about.
Mm.
It just depends on sort of, yeah, I guess my position on the whole thing is just, if something interests you genuinely, then dive in. Or if you have to dive in occasionally to better sort of perform your job, then that's A-okay too, and not something that you should feel, I don't know, shame about doing if you want to be good at your job.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I don't really kind of fall on either side of this. I mean, some of it did kind of resonate with me just because there's sometimes things I just kind of see so much. But I also kind of think there's a deeper question here in terms of how much of our personal identities are wrapped up kind of with our jobs as well.
Yes.
And I think, you know, that's also something that's kind of, you know, something more tough to kind of grapple with in terms
some
of like...
Some people gain genuine pleasure from that though.
Pleasure from what?
From having their identity wrapped up in their job.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. But it also kind of, it does have a lots of kind of problematic overtones, like when companies kind of exploit that, you know, in terms of how they kind of, you know, how they kind of set up their culture in that way. And I think when that is kind of the expectation to do that, and that becomes the majority, especially for a creative career where it's like, you know, people can really take advantage of that. It's like, oh, this is kind of creative. You should just kind of enjoy doing this thing. It's like, well, no, it's like, you know, actually this is kind of more of a craft, or being a creative is yeah, something I kind of do this way. Look, I mean, I
think it's moderation. Like that's the key though, isn't it? Like with everything, right?
That's a golden word today that we're coming back
to. I mean,
it
is. But like, I don't know. I understand his points about what can be gained by shutting these things out of your life. And I understand that definitely for people who are, you know, producing creative output, that absorbing too much can hinder your own ability for originality perhaps. But I also think that there's a huge amount to be lost. Like, and I don't mean in like a FOMO sense. I mean like, you know, and I don't think, you know, everyone needs to be keeping up with everything constantly, but I just think there are a lot of incredibly valuable and challenging viewpoints and ideas out there that we all benefit from interacting with when we do so. And there are a lot of people who are shutting things out in a way that is kind of dangerous. I'm not saying he is, but you risk shutting those things out when you behave like this. And focusing only on yourself can be great for a short period when you need to finish a particular project or something. But I think otherwise, it's kind of a dumb and boring way to exist in the world.
Yeah, well, look, it's a fair point. I think, I mean, I guess the final word I'll say on this is that from a more visual perspective as well, like I do think there's a lot of merit in terms of really trying to just hold yourself accountable to have that kind of varied diet. And especially the way kind of education, the education industry and kind of, you know, conferences can work is sometimes just kind of feed in kind of more of that kind of sameness. But at the same time, it's kind of funny because I've definitely kind of noticed there's like this incredible rejection of trends, which becomes a trend in itself, you know? So it's like, you know, there's obviously a style or kind of a tool or kind of a thing that every illustrator is using, then all of a sudden it's like, whoa, no, it's like everyone's using this. Like, I'm going to go to the complete opposite. And then everyone keeps following you there. And then that
becomes
kind of a
trend.
Yeah, I know.
That's what it is. So influencers find the next cool thing and everyone, you know, the early adopters jump on board and then slowly the masses follow and it ends up at Kmart.
But yeah, but how kind of quickly, you know, like, you know, that just happens kind of so quickly, you know, what is kind of beyond trend in a moment, or
but
how
it's always been the cool guy James Dean thing to be like, you know, I don't listen to mainstream music, I don't read mainstream industry news, I'm too cool for that.
Yeah, but now that the cycles are going so quickly though, it's like, you know, that, like that's like it, is like what is going to kind of replace
I just
that?
Really felt like this was yet another designer dude writing a piece that did not need to exist.
Fair enough.
Look, I still felt that the article had a fair amount of merit. I think that he struggled to get a across the intention fully, but there were aspects of it, such as finding people with outside perspectives, helping your local community, etc. So, like, absolutely, totally agree. But I don't think
Mr.
at the behest of
over here.
Yeah, I know. I don't think at the behest of abandoning, I guess, your own industry to a degree. I mean, yeah, we referenced that I am involved with Pause Fest before. I mean, through getting involved in something like that or attending, you know, I get to see groups like, and we were just chatting about it before, Teenage Engineering. I mean, seeing someone like that present and speak has a formative influence, because I'm sort of looking out for whatever they're doing in the future and whatever new product they're dropping. I don't use synthesizers in my day-to-day job, yeah, etc. But design aesthetics or even just the way that company operates give me a good perspective on what type of
stuff I want to be involved in. It can be just general appreciation for the cool, interesting things that humans can do,
yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
Well, speaking of cool, interesting things that humans can do.
Another good segue.
I didn't actually end it. There's a few ways I could have gone, but yes, I will end it there anyway. Thank you both for that really interesting feedback, and I will move on from there. Our final link from the week, as always, comes from our guest. Gary, as I like to ask everybody, tell us a bit more about your internet hygiene habits. Kind of where do you go and kind of find links or kind of things to read? Are you a Twitter person? Are you an RSS person? Where does it come from? What do you like? And where did you find this one?
Look, it's not that sophisticated the way I, you know, find content. Content finds me. And, you know, the algorithm's got me mapped. But interestingly, it does feed me good content, and I'm not obsessed with just purely having just a stream of tech startup related stuff. I'm fed regularly, I guess, lots of stuff veering into subculture and pop culture. And I wouldn't say that sites that I recall and visit religiously is too much. I rely on, so for instance, I'll check in on the AV Club, you know, every couple of days or so. I'm not using an RSS feed, so it's not that sophisticated, but I find that I can usually consume enough through my LinkedIn and my Twitter feed to give me a good perspective on what's happening in the wider sense, but also within the local community in terms of who's doing what. And LinkedIn has been a really fascinating one, being that it's heavily, heavily used within, you know, your coins tech startup scene, and the way that's changing into a very heavy content platform than simply a job sourcing resource or a way to interact with
the
recruiters.
Revolution. Bianca as well, she is all for LinkedIn. It's like the only thing she reads now.
Yeah, yeah.
And I'm too scared to go on LinkedIn because it's been so long since I updated my profile.
Well, we're doing something now. You have to do it.
I know.
Yeah. And then after that, start producing a lot of LinkedIn video, because that's where it's at the moment.
Jesus, I can't keep up. I'm going to start a farm. I know I always say this.
It's, look, I get fed the content, and that's where this link comes from. But I need that mix of also the humorous and to know what's going on within, I guess, you know, various subculture streams.
You want to know what Kim Kardashian's doing.
Yeah, exactly.
So tell us about this piece. Why did you choose it?
Cool. So this one's from The Atlantic. It found me. And it's called The Instagram Husband Revolution. The men behind the camera are ready to step into the spotlight. I know that on the podcast you've touched on influencers quite a bit. And I mean, you know, quite relevant. I'm pretty sure we've all just watched the Fyre Festival documentary. But I found this one really interesting, not just simply to shine a spotlight on influencers per se, but I guess if you were talking about Instagram husbands in this perspective, what that means as what type of career or careers or projects people are taking on now in this new life. So I'll just read a quick quote in the opening paragraphs, which said, "Those women people laughed at for taking endless photos in front of a brick wall are now influencers, people who leverage a social media following to influence others and make money and are worth millions. We know that. And while men used to be seen as begrudging participants, more so-called Instagram husbands are embracing the term and becoming an integral part of their partner's business." So it started to get me to think about why you would abandon potentially a career that you've worked towards through higher education, the influence of your peers, etc., very good role models and mentors within your life, and suddenly just take this divergent path to follow your partner's passion. I will say, for the purposes of this, that even though it's coined Instagram husband, it's not just husbands. There are people for hire that operate as Instagram husbands. It's obviously not gender specific, but as is the case with culture, it's been coined a term. And there was a video embedded within this article released around 3 years ago. There was a satire on it. So worth a watch. It's funny-ish, but it just shows miserable Instagram husbands at play.
But that's the thing, because the Instagram husband term sort of started as a joke. And I remember seeing Instagram accounts where people would like send in when they'd seen pictures of like boyfriends taking the sort of, you know, the standard like picture of their girlfriend like leaning against a rock or whatever. But, and there's one side of that that is hilarious. And then there's also like, it does make you think, because when it's not just like, you know, some random girlfriend of yours, but rather like these actual, these influencers with that have, you know, huge businesses, right? Like they're making tons of money and doing lots of stuff and producing a shitload of content. You don't often think about, and that's because they obviously don't often, I guess, show it, you know, on the surface, but what actually goes into producing all of that stuff. And I mean, it's very often, I mean, sometimes, and they often start as it's a one person thing, but once it really grows, to think of someone doing that on their own completely without an assistant of any sort, without, I mean, obviously you think the photographer is like the one thing, but then there's also all the sort of like scheduling and the production and all this stuff. There's so much that must actually go into it. And it, yeah, it's a business.
Well, that's why all these kind of other kind of agencies and stuff have kind of popped up to kind of manage those kind of things.
But a lot of them pop up to manage the deal, like as an agent, you know, to connect them with clients. But the actual production of the work, I think, is something that often falls to them alone. And that's why it's interesting to see the partners coming in as the sort of support crew to, I mean, there was a picture where you could see the guy like sort of in the background holding these balloons, like hiding behind a couch, holding these balloons in a perfect position so the girl could get the shot. But it's like, but for example, if you think about it, if it was actually, if it was a photo shoot for anything else, for an ad campaign, for a magazine, whatever, you do have a full crew with people who are set dressing and who are whatever, hair and makeup or whatever, making sure that these things look perfect for this shoot. And it's much the same.
Yeah, I mean, it's really interesting. I mean, oh, man, I don't know. Do you guys know any influencers or any Instagram husbands at all? I mean, because like, it's just, I'm thinking back to our first article, like,
I know like hot girls who have like 6,000 followers, not like influencers.
Well, but that's the thing though. It's like with the whole kind of micro influencer economy and like everyone having their own tribes now, you know, that's probably another reason that this whole thing is on the rise. I mean, but yeah, in our socialist future, like I think this would probably be the first job to go on the chopping block.
Yeah, this could go. I mean, I don't have an Instagram husband. Dan would never do that for me. It's not out of superiority. He just wouldn't do it for me. I also don't know how to smile in photos, but yeah.
But okay, like, you know, as like, you know, you're the partner of someone who runs kind of a small business and does social media. So like, you know, what kind of like are there kind of, how does that kind of affect your, or does it kind of play into your relationship?
Yeah, I actually thought about that a lot, because like I was thinking about how, I mean, not that I'm about to go run the gym with Dan, but I think I was thinking about how like often, yeah, if one partner has a successful business, why not? You know, like a lot of those types of businesses really benefit from being run by people who are not just been partners in business, but partners in like that really understand each other, that can work quickly together, that are with each other a lot, etc. A lot of those small businesses sort of really benefit from that. And so I can see that as a natural step, not necessarily for me. I'd be useless training people in a gym unless I can run like wine and cheese nights or something.
But have you ever
I proofread a lot of stuff for him, things like that, but not really. I mean, like I help when he's had sort of like, I don't know, little events and stuff at the gym. I help sort of plan with that, but not in a very much in a partner helping out capacity, whereas this is sort of talking about how this is partners progressing beyond that, like, hey, I'll lend a helping hand into like actual employee or co-founder or whatever it is, you know, an actual paying role. Whereas I'm not like taking money, taking a paycheck from Dan. I mean, you know, except for all the money I steal from him. And but yeah, I love like peppered throughout this piece, there were all these photos of Instagram husbands taking photos of their, you know, wives or girlfriends. And I couldn't help but wonder, who are the Instagram husband's husbands? Because someone was taking these photos of them taking a photo. So there's like a whole follow-up piece in this.
Yeah. Look, it got me thinking, I guess, around obviously the bemusement at the influencer side type thing, which, yeah, it's just hideous. but also... Around that notion of people latching up by way of their partner, et cetera, and then taking that path away. There was a group that I had seen like recently in the news, fed to me again, but a group called Making Things, who are part of the Start Made Accelerator program in Sydney. So Megan Elizabeth runs Making Things, which is a digital library of 1,500 plus professional knitting and crochet patterns. And she won.
She sounds like an incredible person. I was reading those links you shared.
Yeah, yeah. Also won the 2017 Frankie Goodstuff Small Business category for her ethical yarn project, Wool Days. But her partner, husband, I believe, joined her from Melbourne to move to Sydney when they were accepted into the Start Made Accelerator program. Start Made's a a fantastic accelerator program throughout Australia and really do invest in some pretty substantial but very good groups. So I found this really interesting because there was an opportunity there. They've progressed to this opportunity to uproot and move to a new city. Not quite the same as being an Instagram husband, but it reflects that wants to support a partner when opportunity strikes. Mm-hmm. And it's fascinating.
Yeah, and I mean, if you're going to embark on any sort of, I guess, startup-y, which they are all, I mean, they're sort of solo businesses. It must be vital to have someone who supports, or like rather, even if you don't have someone, but if you are dating someone and they don't support you, I mean, how are you meant to do that?
Yeah.
It sounds awful.
Yeah. I mean, it's no different from, couples kind of working together in any other kind of capacity. I think the thing that really interests me most from a creative perspective is, how this kind of idea of a manufactured reality, affects a relationship. Yeah. That would something that I kind of think would be interesting to kind of dig into kind of
a bit. That quote from, I have to admit, this made me groan, Lindsay Silberman, who's some influencer, I don't know, in the article, she said, talking about her Insta husband, Matt, she said, Matt understands what I do. He understands the nuances of it. When I travel and I need to bring a lot of clothes or wake up in the morning to get the right light, he understands. A vacation doesn't mean laying on a beach drinking pina coladas. That's not how you get the great photos. It's work. And like, I have no doubt that it is an enormous amount of work. Of course it is, but that just sounds like such an awful way to spend a holiday.
Well, no, I mean, I think that brings up like a real kind of core question here in terms of, especially from a creative practice, is because, social media, especially Instagram for artists, photographers, illustrators, no matter who you are, it's such a big part of, of kind of your marketing. We were talking about it this morning, exactly. Mm-hmm. I mean, just this exact thing. And I kind of think, this whole idea of, it used to be a very kind of different thing. We're also looking at a lot of our artists who have many followers and looked at how they, how their kind of presence has changed in terms of kind of being this kind of stream of consciousness thing, mm-hmm. to now being this kind of thing that you actually have to have.
Curated.
Yeah, it has to be curated, it has to be kind of active. And I think a lot of people, this really kind of brings a lot together, especially from the previous link in terms of, kind of what you kind of show, and it has to kind of look a certain way. And I think that affects people's work and kind of what they want to show, and in terms of what the whole idea of community in that way as well. Because if you're an artist putting things out there, nobody wants feedback anymore. They just want kind of praise, basically. And that's kind of where we're getting our kind of own self-worth. So this whole idea, I guess, of Instagram as well, is kind of being this platform that could help you evolve or help you see different things, actually completely now works against that, because it's like, well, you're only going to see more of what you've already kind of seen, and kind of, just more of it. And also, you're not going to get critical feedback. It's just kind of this self-perpetuating thing. So I think it raises a lot of questions. I mean, and how that kind of happens in a context of relationships, just adds a whole other kind of layer to that.
Went deep today.
Well,
it's the hate. It is the hate.
Gary, we didn't get to go through all the kind of different links that you posted over here, but you make some other kind of really interesting connections here, and we will post that all on our show notes if people want to dig into this a bit more.
Cool.
But Gary, thanks again for coming by.
My pleasure.
Having a chat. Appreciate it.
Long time listener, first time. JWGTYB. I can't do it.
You got it.
Before we leave for cooler spaces, it is time for the brilliantly named thumbs up / thumbs down / shaka. The time we dedicate each week to get the good, bad, and the completely groovy off of our chest. Laura, what do you got for us this week?
Oh, my favorite thing. I've got a thumbs up. My favorite thing this week was something that was doing the rounds online. This woman in Wisconsin, she was at a garage sale, or what do you call them? A rummage something. I don't know.
A jumble sale.
No, she called it like a rummage sale or something like that. Yeah. Anyway, she bought this old magazine from 1958 because it had a cover article entitled 129 Ways to Get a Husband. And I thought that was very apt for today. And oh my God, it did not disappoint. The magazine, they basically asked a panel of 16 people to brainstorm suggestions, and they whittled down all of their 404 answers into their list of the top 129. Because in their words, the days have passed when a reasonably pretty girl can sit hands folded on her front veranda waiting for Mr. Right to come along. And I'll read you some of the highlights. So number two was, have your car break down at strategic places. Number six, read the obituaries to find eligible widowers. Number 17, be friendly to ugly men. Number 19, get lost at football games. And my one of my personal favorites, this is one I certainly do. Number 50, practice your drinking with your women friends first. And my personal favorite, which, I mean, if Dan and I ever break up, this is what I'm going straight to. Number 40, stand in a corner and cry softly. Chances are good that he'll come over to find out what's wrong. Anyway, hot tips, we'll link to it in the show notes. Any single ladies out there?
Gary, anything you'd like to kind of particularly endorse, get off your chest, anything?
Yeah, I mentioned this briefly to Lara. There was it's a thumbs up, and my thumbs up is for you, IKEA. Mm-hmm. IKEA, I like what they're doing. They've been dropping some collaborations of late, and I think thinking about how IKEA is sort of progressing, but there's been many collaborations sort of action, but a few I've taken note of is one with Virgil Abloh, which has sort of been well documented throughout that crossover from fashion into life.
Oh, yeah, that rug.
Yeah, yeah. The other one, Teenage Engineering, again, and they've developed some affordable but very funky sound-based products for IKEA stocking. And then the third one, which is one I saw recently, which was around Sonos and integration into smart technology type home. So nothing too much more at it than that. But I just think it's really interesting identifier of, I guess, whoever's leading from the top in terms of IKEA's strategic direction and how they're, yeah, changing and moving whilst also retaining their lack and whatever other their staple items are. I still consume IKEA, not heaps, and it's moved on a lot from obviously when I was first out of home in share house type style. But I just find it really interesting that they're starting to bring in these products that you will just need to have to some degree and apply some sort of scarcity to it, I guess.
Yeah. And the meatballs are pretty good too.
Oh, meatballs are great.
I think after influencer marketing in our, you know, socialist future, IKEA's probably not going to be around either. What do you reckon? You think they would be, but I don't know.
I don't know. I think they might make it.
Anyway, what did you have? A thumbs up, a thumbs down?
I had a thumbs up.
You had two thumbs up.
Gary had a thumbs up.
Okay, I'm going to do a shaka for the cool change, the one that will hopefully be coming in about 2
3 hours. 3 p.m.
Related to an amazing website that I found called OGMet, which has a world ranking of selected weather parameters. Oh. And so it gives you the maximum temperature and minimum temperature of different places over, you know, at the day. So right now, Australia is pretty much, it is almost has a monopoly of the top 100, but has not beat Grasscop in South Africa, where it's currently a lovely 49.2. Also, even for Red Rocks Point in Australia, also at 49.2
that's
right
brutal.
Now. So it ranks around 8,457 weather stations. And on the flip side, in Selagonsi in Russia, it is -48.3.
Jesus, that's like 90 degrees of difference. That's insane.
What a topsy-turvy world
we
live in.
How are we not all dead?
I don't know. Anyway, Gary, if people who aren't dead want to find out more about you, where can they do that on the internet?
Look, I'm mostly at handle at G Williams Alts, ALTS. Pretty active across Twitter, Instagram, and LinkedIn. But look, I'll be developing and bringing some new things as a side venture throughout this year. And obviously, I run quite a few events throughout Melbourne and Sydney, so I'm usually pretty available to say hello to people when they come up and say g'day.
I certainly do.
If you decide to start like a separate kind of like side hustle, like selling spices and salt, you can be G William Salt. You have to change your surname though.
Oh, Jeremy.
What? Come on.
It's perfect. It's perfect.
You got to give me one dad joke at least every...
Yeah, you are a dad, I guess. You get one per kid, so you get 2 dad jokes a day.
Sweet. Yeah. Fire Festival also got me thinking about whether I should develop an influencer-led music festival on the Sapphire Coast during the time when Jeremy holidays there, but that's another story.
Definitely.
Okay, that'll do us for this week. I'm Jeremy Wartzman, she's Lara Chan Baker, and this has been Jackie Winter Gives You the Business. Our theme music is by totally unrelated to our company, Melbourne-based musician Jackie Winter. You can check out his stuff on soundcloud.com/JackieWinter. If you want more JWGYTB, archives of all of our shows and the links can be found at jackiewinter.givesyouthe.biz. We have recently completely overhauled our newsletter, combined it with the main Jackie Winter newsletter, so if you want to receive all the links we talk about in the show each week in one nice, neat little package, sign up to our newsletter at jwg.is/newslettering. Again, jwg.is/newslettering. You can also find us mostly on Instagram at Jackie Winter. That's Jackie with a Y and Winter like the season. And hit us up with any recommendations, feedback, questions, or comments at podcast@jackiewinter.com. If you like what you hear, you can really help us out. Rate us on iTunes, and you can also get the show everywhere else you get podcasts, including Spotify and Stitcher. Remember, this is an enhanced podcast. If you listen to this using Pocket Cast, Overcast, Castro, Apple Podcasts, any supported player, you'll be able to see links and visual content as we're talking about them. And if you work for an advertising agency or design studio and are interested in our live extended version of the show called Open Tabs, be sure to check out opentabs.rodeo for more info. Thanks for listening. Catch you next week. Bye. Bye.
Anything that comes up is fine. It's just to help us like have something so we don't get to the recording and we're like, and no one has anything to say.
Yeah, so, of course. Yeah.